Thank you.
Great.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, January 21st, Clinton Street Resistance will screen King, a filmed record, From Montgomery to Memphis, a historic documentary, nominated for a Best Documentary Oscar in 1971. The screen benefits the Children's Book Bank. Again, that's King, a film record, showing Monday, January 21st at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the NAACP kickoff to Black History Month on Saturday, January 26th at 1 p.m. at the Fort Vancouver Library in Vancouver, Washington. The NAACP kickoff to Black History Month features performances from African drummers, actors and storytellers, artist talks, a presentation by the Buffalo Soldiers of Fort Vancouver, and much more. Again, that's the NAACP kickoff to Black History on Saturday, January 26th at 1 p.m. at the Fort Vancouver Library, 901 C Street in Vancouver, Washington. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Golden Years in the Red on Tuesday, January 29th at 5:30 p.m. at the Multnomah County Central Library in Portland. Golden Years in the Red with student debt will feature informational speakers and people who will share their stories about debt, including garnishment of Social Security checks for student debt when grandparents and parents co-sign student loans. Again, that's Golden Years in the Red on Tuesday, January 29th at 5:30 p.m. at the Central Library, 810 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor La Segua, running February 7th to March 2nd at the Milagro Theater in Portland. La Segua is a Central American cautionary folktale of a young, beautiful woman whom philandering men encounter on their way back home. Her beauty decays into a horror that drives the men mad. The play tells the story of a beautiful woman who was haunted by the specter of La Segua and takes a hard look at Costa Rican values, including ambition, hypocrisy, and follows themes of machismo, vanity, and narcissism. Again, that's La Segua, running February 7th to March 2nd on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights at 7:30 and Sundays at 2 p.m. at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 29th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from Friday, February 1st through Saturday, March 2nd. The Cascade Festival of African Films represent different countries and cultures and a range of lifestyles from pre-colonial to modern times, including both rural and urban settings. Films include Razzia, a film from Morocco, and more at the Hollywood Theater, and Wale from Burkina Faso, Fig Tree from Ethiopia, shorts from emerging African filmmakers, and many more at the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Room 104, at the PCC Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. Again, that's the 29th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from Friday, February 1st through Saturday, March 2nd. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Northwest Film Center's Real Music Festival from January 18th through February 16th at the Witzel Auditorium in Portland. Films showing this year include Mr. Soul, The Ballad of Shirley Collins, Solo, The Evolution of the One Man Band, Gospel According to Al Green, and many more. Again, that's the Northwest Film Center's Real Music Festival from January 18th through February 16th at the Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 6.05 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
Good evening, Portland. This is Labor Radio. I am your host, Michael Cathcart. Thank you, as always, for tuning in on this rainy, well, sort of rainy evening here in Portland, Oregon. I'm coming to you on Martin Luther King Day 2019. And if you've been listening to the station at all over the past few hours, the rest of the day, you likely have heard, you know, more than your fair share of amazing information about Martin Luther King Jr., who was an incredible man. I am going to continue talking about him just for a bit here, but I'm going to take a slightly different approach to it. I'm going to talk about it from a labor perspective, since this is, in fact, Labor Radio. So I'd like to start off the evening. You know, one of the things that, and it's likely that you probably have heard this at some point over the last few years or even in the last few hours today, but the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. is something that tends to be skewed or whitewashed often by, you know, those in power to serve their own needs or to, you know, maybe, you know, share some language with, you know, the activist community, but without actually necessarily meaning, having any of the force of meaning behind it. And one of the things that does tend to get washed out of his legacy is his, you know, truly radical points of view and his approach to organizing, and particularly towards the end of his life. You know, once he came out against the Vietnam War, realizing that, you know, how can we be engaging, how can we be trying to bring about true civil rights in this country when we're engaging in an imperial war for basically no reason, you know, halfway around the world. That's sort of the moment that it seems his legacy, or at least in the time that he was alive, the people's opinions of him in power shifted from, well, you know, we'll deal with him, we'll tolerate him, and as long as he doesn't, you know, come at the system of power that keeps us in charge, you know, someone like Lyndon Johnson, who may have supported him on things like the Great Society, but when it came to the Vietnam War, when King came out against the war, that was a turning point for Johnson in his support for Martin Luther King. So, you know, that's something that's a moment that really does change in his history and his trajectory. And he, at that moment, also starts to really understand the importance of organized labor and bringing together poor people of all nationalities, races, you know, creeds, to come together to form, you know, a true grassroots movement to bring about true equality, both, you know, racial, gender, but also economic equality in this country. And so that's sort of the angle that I want to approach his legacy from today. I pulled out a few quotes that over the course of the 60s, you know, which was some of his most prominent speeches, but also quotes I never really heard before. that pertain that he said that pertain to labor specifically. The first one is from 1965, October of 1965. It is from an Illinois AFL-CIO convention. And he really is just talking here about the history of the labor movement and the rise of organized labor. King said, "At the turn of the century, women earned approximately 10 cents an hour, and men were fortunate to receive 20 cents an hour. The average work week was 60 to 70 hours. During the 30s, wages were a secondary issue. To have a job at all was the difference between the agony of starvation and a flicker of life. The nation, now so vigorous, reeled and tottered almost to total collapse. The labor movement was the principal force that transformed misery and despair into hope and progress. Out of its bold struggles, economic and social reform gave birth to unemployment insurance, old age pensions, government relief for the destitute, and above all, new wage levels that meant not mere survival, but a tolerable life. The captains of industry did not lead this transformation. They resisted it until they were overcome. When in the 30s the wave of union organization crested over our nation, it carried to secure shores not only itself, but the whole society." And that's a pretty succinct description of how, you know, organized labor really did shift the course of this country during the Great Depression and bring about the boom that led, you know, came out of World War II that I think tends to get overlooked somewhat by, you know, the buildup of industrialization during World War II. A lot of the, you know, if you want to talk about going back to making America great or whatever, you know, folks tend to wax poetic about a time in the past when America was thriving. It's generally, you know, they obviously or generally have in mind sometime just beyond the World War II, somewhere into the 50s, at least for, you know, white America. That's not true for the rest of the country. But working white people had a chance to earn a true, you know, living wage or, you know, a thriving wage and be able to live with one, you know, one family member working on one single job. And so, you know, that was in due in large part to the fact that there was a massive organizing effort and, you know, throughout the 30s and into the 40s that allowed for a strong base to then build upon when the New Deal came about. So that's the first quote. The next quote that I have comes a few years later. It's in 1968, and it was given at I don't actually have the exact forum that it was given in, but it was a union meeting as well in March of 1968. And in this quote, he talks about the importance of livable wages and family wages. And, you know, doesn't directly say it, but it speaks to the need to raise the minimum wage or to have a high minimum wage or the importance of a minimum wage at all. And he says, "We look around every day and we see thousands and millions of people making inadequate wages. Not only do they work in our hospitals, they work in our hotels, they work in our laundries, they work in domestic service. They find themselves underemployed. You see, no labor is really menial unless you're not getting adequate wages. People are always talking about menial labor. But if you're getting a good wage, as I know that through some unions they've brought it up, this is not menial labor. What makes it menial is the income, the wages," which I think is very true. There's dignity to all work, and that, you know, it's only a menial job, as he's saying, if you can't even make ends meet. If you're making less than a living wage, then those jobs are deemed menial simply by virtue of the fact that you cannot make a living on those jobs. The jobs themselves don't really, you know, the value ascribed to them seems to come more from how much money, how much income you can get from it, rather than the sense of purpose or the, you know, the hard day's work that you get from it. And then jumping slightly back in time, this is, I think, one of the more poignant quotes, but this is from 1967, May, at the SCLC staff retreat. And this is sort of, you know, him speaking towards a new vision, a radical vision to reshape society and the need for a working class revolution. And it sort of this idea here is the genesis of the Poor People's Campaign. And King said, I think it is necessary for us to realize that we have moved from the era of civil rights to the era of human rights, when we see that there must be a radical redistribution of economic and political power. Then we see that for the last 12 years, we have been in a reform movement, that after Selma and the Voting Rights Bill, we moved into a new era, which must be an era of revolution. In short, we have moved into an era where we are called upon to raise certain basic questions about the society as a whole. And that, you know, there's a lot to be said, or there's a lot to be parsed out of there, but King is essentially saying that, you know, there needs to be a intersectional or a all-encompassing movement to bring together working class people, poor people from across the country in order to struggle to reshape society, not just for one individual group or not just in one individual, you know, sector of the economy or society, but as a whole, in order to make the society more equitable for working people and for the American people as a whole. And the final quote that I have here is, this is likely one that has maybe even come up at some point today, and it's maybe one of his more famous, from one of his more famous speeches. It was given on April 3rd, 1968, in Memphis to the sanitation workers who were out on strike. And basically he's talking about the dignity of a blue-collar job. He says, "You are demanding that this city will respect the dignity of labor. So often we overlook the work and the significance of those who are not in professional jobs, of those who are not in the so-called big jobs. But let me say to you tonight that whenever you are engaged in work that serves humanity and is for the building of humanity, it has dignity and it has worth." And that, you know, that definitely gets to a lot that I will be going over in a minute, but something else that's a little, you know, poignant about that is that that was given on April 3rd, 1968 in Memphis, and if you know your history, the next day he was unfortunately assassinated in Memphis there. And so this is one of the last speeches he gave to the world right here. And it's, you know, it's telling that he was speaking directly to workers. He identified that these workers on strike in Memphis, that was a necessary movement that he had to be a part of, a moment that he had to be a part of. And I think it speaks to, as I've been saying, the shift that he found towards the need to really raise up working class people. And so just a little bit of background on that, the strike that was taking place and what that quote was directed, or the people that quote was directed towards. King was in Memphis, as I mentioned, in support of striking African-American city sanitation workers. There had been, in February of that year of 1968, there had been an accident. Two sanitation workers were driving in a sanitation truck, a compactor truck, and there was an accident and they both died. It was, I believe it had something to do with the negligence or safety. Not on the part of the operators of the vehicle, but on the part of people who were supposed to, or the company that was supposed to maintain the truck. And so that was basically the final straw, the straw that broke the camel's back. And the workers who had been fed up with, you know, unsafe working conditions and low wages decided at that moment to go on strike. And so they were protesting unequal wages and unequal working conditions imposed by I'm editorializing here, but the racist mayor of Memphis, Henry Loeb. And at that time, the black workers within the sanitation department of the city were paid lower wages than their white counterparts. So working in the same job, white workers made more money than their black counterparts. So that's right there. That's a reason to go on strike if there weren't anything on top of that. But there also was a few other issues. They also did not receive uniforms provided for them by their employer. They did not receive there were no restrooms available to them while working, which, you know, they're out collecting trash, they're out in the city, but still those jobs typically provide a place for them to pull over and use the restroom, use the facilities, because, you know, I think that speaks to the lack of dignity, the dehumanization that came with so much of this, you know, quote unquote menial work that King was speaking about. And on top of that, you know, even more egregious was that the city would not recognize the union that the workers had, they'd organized together, and they had tried to form a union. The city wouldn't recognize it, and therefore there was no mechanism for them to file a grievance if they, you know, they were chronically underpaid, and there was no mechanism for them to file a grievance against that. So those are the conditions that led them to go on strike. And so King came down and supported their strike and spoke to them. And so, you know, as I've been saying, the quote that I mentioned there, you know, about the dignity of the job, that it really does speak to the fact that, you know, so much of the work that is necessary to make society run, to keep things working day to day, you know, it's not glamorous work. It's not jobs that you necessarily dream of. Well, I mean, personally, when I was very young, I wanted to be a garbage man. I would chase the garbage truck down the street. But I don't know that that's necessarily every kid's dream. But, you know, you don't necessarily revere these jobs, or you don't aspire to do them, but they are absolutely necessary jobs. They're jobs that have to happen to make society run. And there is dignity in that, in doing something that allows the city, the society, the civilization that you're a part of, to continue to function properly. And so, yeah, there's inherent dignity because what you're doing serves humanity. And that's basically pulled directly from the quote that I mentioned from Dr. King. And so, you know, this sort of, this mentality, this morality is what led to, or what was basically within the underlying moral framework for the Poor People's Campaign that began, you know, with that speech that I was mentioning from King, but it lasted far beyond him. And it brought together workers from, you know, all walks of life within this country to fight to bring, you know, to end the dehumanization and to bring dignity to working class jobs. And yeah, so the Poor People's Campaign was workers fighting against dehumanization, discrimination, and poverty wages in what is the richest country in the world, and at that time was also the richest country in the world. So yeah, the Poor People's Campaign was, or the sanitation strike really kind of captured, or was a microcosm of what the Poor People's Campaign was attempting to do on a national scale. So yeah, as I mentioned, the next day, King was unfortunately assassinated in Memphis. But those quotes are still, you know, that his presence at that strike was still very meaningful, and it led to a furthering of his legacy. And so, as I was saying at the beginning, his legacy has certainly been shifted, or has been whitewashed, sanitized in a lot of ways, you know, depending on who it is that's bringing up, you know, King. So often, you know, even today I saw that the president, Donald Trump, quoted or tweeted, because that's what he does, he tweeted out a message praising Dr. King, saying something to the effect of, you know, no matter the color of our skin or place of our birth, we are all created equal by God, which at this particular moment in time is especially grating, considering that he is currently fighting to put up, you know, for $5 billion to put up a wall to essentially exclude people because of the place of their birth or the color of their skin. So that's an aside. But we've all seen it. We've all seen people use, you know, degrade his legacy to the point where it's just sort of general platitudes about love and peace and togetherness. And actually, I found an article by Cornel West that was written last year on MLK Day, but he kind of sums up the need to, or he attacks the need to kind of to whitewash the legacy, and actually talks about the need to really look at King's legacy as a whole and to examine all parts of it. And if you're going to reference him, if you're going to, you know, revere King, you have to understand his entire life. And so what Cornel West said, and this was an article in The Guardian from 2018, he said, "In this brief celebratory moment of King's life and death, we should be highly suspicious of those who sing his praises yet refuse to pay the cost of embodying King's strong indictment of the U.S. empire, capitalism, and racism in their own lives. These neoliberal revisionists thrive on the spectacle of their smartness and the visibility of their mainstream status. Yet rarely, if ever, have they said a mumbling word about what would have concerned King, such as U.S. drone strikes, house raids, torture sites, or raise their voices about escalating inequality, poverty, or Wall Street domination under neoliberal administrations, but be the president black or white. The killing of Martin Luther King Jr. was the ultimate result of the fusion of ugly white supremacist elites in the U.S. government and citizenry and cowardly liberal careerists who feared King's radical moves against empire, capitalism, and white supremacy. If King were alive today, his words and witness against drone strikes, invasions, occupations, police murders, as well as capitalist wealth inequality and poverty, would threaten most of those who now sing his praises. Needless to say, his relentless condemnation of Trump's escalating neo-fascist rule would be unequivocal, but not to be viewed as an excuse to downplay some of the repressive continuities of the two Bush, Clinton, and Obama administrations. So that, you know, as Cornel West is wont to do, he often sums things up and explains things much better than I could ever dream to. So, yeah, that's basically the overall point that I'm getting at, is that there's so often times where people reference his legacy, speak about King, while they themselves are taking part in things or making legislation or running companies in ways that directly are a direct affront to the true legacy of Dr. King. And so on a day where you're going to have people from all different ends of the political spectrum, the economic spectrum, speaking, you know, sharing their praises of King, I think it's good to get a true reading of his radical legacy as well into the mix. And so with that, I will move on, although as I'm looking at the clock, I have about 1 minute. So just to cap things off here, I'd like to give a shout out to the teachers in Los Angeles who are currently on strike. They have been for over a week now. And with no end in sight, there's over 33,000 teachers in Los Angeles, part of United Teachers of Los Angeles Union down there. Los Angeles is the second largest school district in the country, and they are fully on strike. By comparison, to give a little example, West Virginia, which was the teachers went on strike last year, and that sparked a wildfire of walkouts and strikes from teachers all around the country. The entire state, all the teachers in that state went out on strike, and there were 20,000 of them. In the city of Los Angeles alone, there are 33,000 educators who are out on strike right now. And so not only are they supported by their union, by that strong base, but they also have the support of a large majority of the residents of Los Angeles, you know, made up in no small part by people whose kids are to be educated by those teachers. But it makes sense, you know, if those parents trust the teachers to educate their kids, to prepare them for the future, why would they not trust them, trust their judgment, and what are the proper conditions needed to make sure that their kids are able to learn properly? You know, the teachers' working conditions are also the students' learning conditions. So I think that's an important element of why the community supports what these teachers are doing. And you know, they're asking for a modest raise, but it has sparked, you know, in other walkouts as well. In Oakland, the 500 teachers from 10 schools carried out a wildcat sick out on Friday, and they're looking for just a small raise in pay as well as working conditions. And in Virginia, on January 28th, teachers in that state are going to be holding a rally in front of the legislature, basically asking for higher wages, and they're unhappy that they're making $9,000 less than the national average for teachers at the same time that the state legislature, and that's imposed by the state legislature, and that's at the same time that state legislature just approved more than $573 million in tax breaks for Amazon to move their new headquarters to Northern Virginia. So just a shout out to the teachers who are out there on strike fighting for what's right. We here at Labor Radio are in solidarity with you. That is all the time I have. If you want to get in touch with me, if you're interested in discussing these issues further, you can find me on Twitter at Michael B. Kath, or, you know, you can contact KBOO. Otherwise, I will see you here next month. Have a great night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KABU Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, January 21st, Clinton Street Resistance will screen King, a filmed record, From Montgomery to Memphis, a historic documentary, nominated for a Best Documentary Oscar in 1971. The screen benefits the Children's Book Bank. Again, that's King, a film record, showing Monday, January 21st at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Northwest Film Center's Real Music Festival from January 18th through February 16th at the Witzel Auditorium in Portland. Films showing this year include Mr. Soul, The Ballad of Shirley Collins, Solo, The Evolution of the One Man Band, Gospel According to Al Green, and many more. Again, that's the Northwest Film Center's Real Music Festival from January 18th through February 16th at the Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.